Taking Stock on News Talk.
Thanks to Skillnet Ireland, driving business success through innovative training and upskilling.
We're joined now by Simon Cooper, author and columnist with the Financial Times. Simon, you're very welcome and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Simon, we're going to discuss Brexit. It's obviously in the news at the moment in terms of whether some sort of skinny trade deal is ultimately hammered out between the EU and the UK. But the actual vote took place 4 years ago, and we're not going to get into the ins and outs of why that happened now. But you have been looking at very interesting research through the summer, 4 years on, with middle and higher income earners in the UK, and it was those particularly on the Leave side who voted most to leave the UK, and some fascinating attitudes emerging towards the whole process and the whole idea 4 years on.
Yeah, I mean, this was a whole series of focus groups around the country done on Zoom, organised by NatSen, which is a research institution, and UK and Changing Europe. So, and I also got separately from another NGO their focus groups on Brexit. So if you add it all together, it's a very wide view of what Leavers and Remainers are saying now. And a couple of points really struck me. One is that the whole feeling has gone out of the battle. I mean, both sides are distracted by the coronavirus. People are ceasing to identify strongly as Leavers and Remainers. They have other worries broadly, as you know, Britain heads into a massive recession, coronavirus is uncured, etc. So that's good news, the kind of latent civil war that might be developing in the US. You don't see that in the UK at all. There's more conciliation. The bad news, I suppose, is that people are very pessimistic, even Leavers, about Brexit. There's almost nobody who thinks, you know, that the sunny uplands lie ahead anymore. Leavers tended generally to be quite skeptical of politics, of governments before Brexit, and they've reverted to that stance. So there's not much faith that, you know, Johnson is going to conclude brilliant trade deals. People have also come to associate trade deals with Donald Trump and his chlorinated chickens. So there's not much excitement about that. So you could say that the mood is conciliatory, resigned, pessimistic. Remainers have given up the battle. They really don't believe in Brexit. Remainers have not been convinced about the virtues of Brexit, but they sort of believe it's going to happen, has to happen. And generally, I found that people were not thinking about it. I mean, the negotiations that you mentioned earlier are depressing. They're very technical. They're likely not to turn out well for the UK, even if there is a skinny deal. Obviously, there'd still be massive customs checks, less free trade with Europe. And so people have kind of buried their heads in the sand, distracted by the coronavirus, and don't quite, I think, realize the economic shock that might well be ahead, you know, if in January Kent turns into a lorry park.
And if that is the case, that they're, for all sorts of reasons, not focused on that, Simon, what do you think the implications might be if some of the worst warnings come to pass?
Well, I mean, as people have said in the focus groups, it's going to be hard to disentangle any Brexit shock, which Leavers also expect, certainly on the short term, from the COVID shock. I mean, a huge number, millions of jobs are now currently protected by government, and the furlough scheme protecting those jobs is in part ending. It's going to be a longer crisis than people had thought in March. And so a lot of jobs are just being destroyed anyway. And so when Brexit comes, it's going to come into a society that is already on a very big downturn, you know, the biggest economic crisis that we've had in probably 80 years or even more. So 90 years or even more. And so it's going to be hard to say what the Brexit effect is. But since people, you know, the majority of the population polls show are now against Brexit, they believe it was a bad idea. So there's not much buy-in for Brexit anymore. So any harm that's perceived to come from Brexit, let's say if a car plant in Sunderland closes down because tariffs on cars make producing cars in the UK unaffordable, which is all very plausible. If farmers start going bust because they can't export anymore, if universities start closing down because they can't get as many students, then people are not going to say, oh, well, it's worth it to suffer some short-term pain for Brexit. Only a small core of Leavers believe that. So I think a likely outcome is rising discontent with this government and with Brexit itself.
I was, and I think it is important for Europeans generally, and we Irish obviously, because not only are we their nearest neighbours, but they're still a huge trading partner with us, and will always remain so. So, to try and get a feeling for how the British on both sides of the divide feel now, I think is important. And it was interesting, I think the research that you outlined, that those who voted Leave didn't have anything except relatively positive feelings about Europeans generally, still a little bit negative about Brussels and the money sink they think it is, but they were still very strong on one of the core elements, the feeling that immigrants were scroungers.
Yeah, I mean, in the Leaver comments, I thought, you know, who are they going to have as their enemy? Is it going to be elitist Remainers, you know, out of touch, rich people in London? Not really. Nobody mentioned that. Literally nobody mentioned that. Are they going to, you know, lash out at Germans, French, Irish people? No. People, Leavers also repeatedly expressed their admiration and fondness for many foreign countries. And generally the hope was that Britain post-Brexit would be a, you know, a good partner, a friend of those countries, and not, as one Leaver said, a country that just says Yabu sucks to everyone else. Nobody really wanted a Britain that goes it alone. And so who are their enemies? Well, it was an age-old tabloid enemy that Leavers kept coming back to in these focus groups, which is the benefit scrounger, the person who just lies on the sofa drinking tinnies and drawing enormous amounts of money in outrageously huge benefits from the government. Of course, this is an imaginary figure. I mean, UK benefits are not generous. And it's an imaginary figure that has been nurtured by the tabloids for decades. But sometimes this scrounger that people complain about was an immigrant. But more often it was a British person. So one woman, I think in the West Midlands, says English people are feral. If you stub your toe, you get disability allowance for life and you never work again. So there was a lot of kind of dissatisfaction about the English as benefit scroungers, and especially also complaints about young people. It's not that Leavers hate young people, but they really don't seem to understand the mentality of that generation. You know, why young people are anti-Brexit, why young people are not applying to work as fruit pickers, you know, given that the immigrant fruit pickers have left and much of the British harvest rotted. So there was a lot of incomprehension about young people. They don't want to work. They just want to be social media influencers. And so these were the main targets of Leaver complaints. And that made me feel that the dissatisfaction that prompted Brexit was a dissatisfaction not just with foreigners, but with the UK itself. A lot of Leavers despair about the UK. I suspect that feeling is shared by many Brexiter politicians, but of course, as a politician, you can never sort of express despair about your own country, especially not if you are the governing party.
It's a very depressing scenario, Simon, isn't it? Because as you say, on the other side of the fence, those who voted Remain have lost the stomach for the fight. The fight is over as far as they're concerned. And those that have a stomach for any fight have changed focus perhaps to issues like the environment.
Yeah, I mean, Remainers believe that it was a fair vote, or even if it wasn't a fair vote, you know, we lost the match. And we can argue about the refereeing and the other side cheating, but we lost. And in the spirit of British fair play, we should accept defeat. And so there's this very strange thing going on in the UK that although the majority thinks that Brexit is a bad idea, the majority also thinks that Brexit should happen because of the referendum results. And so Leavers also think it should go ahead. And, you know, I share this belief that Brexit has to fail before Brexit can be reversed. So even though most people don't want Brexit anymore, in a very strange way, we're seeing through a policy that the population doesn't support, and a policy that's really going to change the UK much more fundamentally than anything, any government policy in recent memory.
And on that point, and perhaps I'm being overly optimistic myself here, do you believe because of these attitudes that are being divined on both sides of the issue, and on the basis that even those Leavers, even those who voted Leave, have lost any great rallying aspirations that they might have had, it seems, that over time there may be a greater tendency to move back to a stronger trading relationship with the EU, never to go back in, but a stronger trading relationship.
I think that's right. I think that's going to be the short-term shift. So we'll start with maybe a no deal, but soon a skinny trade deal. So no deal would never be a long-term scenario. It would just be a short-term disaster, would quickly be reversed, and you'd get a kind of minimalist trading deal of the kind that they're trying to negotiate now. So I think stage one is a minimalist trading deal, which is not enough to sustain the UK economy in sectors like farming and cars. And then the UK starts to put out feelers, maybe on the subsequent government, to say to the EU, look, you know, can't we rejoin the single market? It's not so difficult because our laws, you know, had been totally in accordance with the single market for 40 years. And so it's not a huge jump to get back to that. So I think that UK rejoining the single market is the next stage. But the thing is, you know, then you become like Norway or Switzerland, that you cooperate in the single market, but you don't have a seat at the table. Now, that's OK if you're Norway, because Norway is a small country not used to having a seat at the table. Britain has always had a seat at every table. So there's going to be growing frustration that, you know, we participate in this market, but all the important decisions, for example, about, you know, the powers of the City of London and the rights the city has to, for example, trade in euro-denominated assets are curtailed, and so the city starts being hived off to places like Dublin and Paris. The UK is just not going to live with not having a seat at the table. So then you're going to get this movement to say, okay, this hasn't worked out. We should look at rejoining.
Wow, yeah. Let's hope we're all alive and alive again. Our guest here on News Talk is Simon Cooper, discussing the current attitudes of both Remainers and Leavers 4.5 years on in the United Kingdom to the Brexit, to the whole Brexit situation. Simon, we talked to you earlier in the year about the situation in Paris, where you live, as a result of COVID-19, and we know that many countries and many cities across the across Europe are heading into effectively dealing with the second wave, and in many cases, including our own here, effective lockdowns. How is the situation broadly in Paris now? And has that exodus of lower paid people who worked in the hospitality sector, the entertainment sector in that wonderful city, has that come about as you sort of predicted?
Well, we're under a curfew, so you can't go out after 9 p.m. and until 6 a.m. So the idea was to close down parties and nightlife where young people especially were passing the virus to each other. The infection rate is very, very high. The death rate, thankfully, is nowhere near what it was in the spring. I think less than 10% of what it was. But still, you know, the infection rate is out of control here and hospitals are filling up. I don't go into restaurants anymore. You know, I don't feel safe. But today I was able to eat a meal, a lunch on a terrace, because it's one of the last nice days of autumn. But it's going to be a very long winter here, you know, when it's going to be too cold to sit outside, too dangerous to sit inside. And so everyone is going to be pretty much locked up in their own private life, unable to go out in the evenings. Thankfully, you know, work continues. The French are now encouraging télétravail, working from home, which French companies were not at all keen on because they like to supervise their employees personally. My kids are still at school. My daughter had to quarantine after a corona case near her. So there's all sorts of that kind of thing happening. But it seems that schools are not big spreaders of the virus. So the schools have managed to keep going. And so society is much more functional than it was in the spring, when really we were all locked up at home all the time. France does not want to go through that again.
And have those who are, you know, generally lower paid and who work in the entertainment and hospitality sectors, have they managed to be able to stay? Has the French government or the city of Paris supported them?
Yeah, I mean, I think the impact is going to be much earlier in London or New York, say. You know, in the US, they didn't protect jobs. So if you worked in a restaurant or a bar or a hotel, you lost your job pretty much immediately. And without a job, you really can't afford to live in an expensive city like New York or San Francisco. In London, you know, jobs were protected for some months, but that's now waning. So in my FT column today, I forecast that lesser paid people are going to move out of those cities. In Paris, jobs are still protected. So you get, you know, something like 80% of your salary. So if you are a waiter or a hotel receptionist, you work at the airport, you know, effectively you're not working, but the government is paying you just about enough that you can hang on in the city. So if there's a vaccine, say by next summer, and Macron said, don't expect life to resume before next summer. if by next summer there's a vaccine, then those people may have been able to ride out the crisis. I mean, of course, there is already places closing down. The cafe on my corner is boarded up. In opposite my office, there's a soup kitchen. I walked past a very long queue there at lunchtime today. So, you know, this is a city of tourists without any tourists. So a huge amount of economic damage is being done.
And has the COVID crisis put on hold the very radical plan by the mayor, Anne Hidalgo, to make it a greener city, an easier city to live in and walk and cycle about and almost bring the villages of Paris back? Has that great experiment in sustainability been put on hold?
Au contraire, that great experiment has been accelerated by the coronavirus. So I now cycle everywhere. The bike lanes are full. I mean, there's about 70% more bikes than this time last year. There's new bike lanes popping up all the time in places where, you know, never expected them before. The whole Rue de Rivoli, which is the kind of central east-west route of Paris, is now closed to cars. There's two separate two-way bike lanes, so you can kind of cycle like a king across the main, you know, main road of central Paris. So it's absolutely becoming a greener city. Hidalgo, the mayor, put out an ad on social media yesterday saying, what shall we do with 50% of our parking spaces? Shall we turn them into little gardens? Shall we turn them into terraces, into playgrounds? Let's have a public discussion about this. So I think the Parisian route, which they've been talking about, of actually banning private cars eventually from the city, that is very much being accelerated by the coronavirus, because this city just doesn't have enough space for all the cars that want to come in. So the only way to move people around here is by public transport, which is functioning but dangerous now, or by bike.
Oh, we'll never waste a crisis. We'll leave it there, Simon, and thanks indeed for talking to us about the changing face of Brexit in the United Kingdom and the changing face of Paris where you live. That's Simon Cooper, author and columnist with the Financial Times. Simon, thanks indeed for joining us.
Thank you.
Taking stock on News Talk.
Thanks to Skillnet Ireland, driving business success through innovative training and upskilling.